Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
From WBUR in Boston, it's Here and Now. I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney. Coming up, and it's on to New Hampshire. Senator John Kerry arrives in the Granite State early this morning after a stunning victory in Iowa last night.
Thank you for a wonderful, warm welcome on a cold morning in New Hampshire.
Howard Dean regroups after a tumble to third. Senator John Edwards takes second, surprising even his biggest supporters.
I talked to my parents last night. They were so exuberant and so excited. But it's hard not to be a little surprised by somebody who in 3 weeks went from 5% in the polls to 32%.
It's a whole new ballgame. These stories and more coming up here and now.
The news is first.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Craig Windham. Fresh off his convincing victory in the Iowa caucuses, Massachusetts Senator John Kerry got an enthusiastic welcome from supporters in New Hampshire today.
I'm running because I, like many Americans, don't think it's right that George Bush places his buddies as the first priority of America. I'm running for president to put New Hampshire and its citizens first. And that's what we need to do.
Kerry said despite his win in Iowa, though, he still considers himself an underdog in New Hampshire, where voters will go to the polls next Tuesday. Retired General Wesley Clark and Senator Joseph Lieberman chose to bypass Iowa, and they've been campaigning intensively in New Hampshire. Former Vermont Governor Howard Dean said he will step up his efforts in New Hampshire after a third-place finish in Iowa. But the candidate who finished in fourth place is expected to drop out of the race today, as Stuart Cohen reports from Des Moines.
The second time was no charm for Missouri Congressman Dick Gebhardt. Despite gaining strong union support in Iowa and being a fellow Midwesterner from a neighboring state, Gebhardt never emerged from the shadows of the frontrunners, Howard Dean and then John Kerry. The most recent Iowa polls from this past weekend showed Gebhardt in fourth place among the four leading candidates, and that's exactly where he finished when the final results of the Iowa caucus were tallied. Observers here said Gebhardt needed a strong showing in Iowa to remain a viable candidate for the Democratic nomination. He didn't get it, and at a speech to supporters after the caucuses, he all but threw in the towel. Gebhardt canceled plans to go to New Hampshire, the site of next week's primary, and instead has scheduled a news conference in his hometown of St. Louis later today. For NPR News, I'm Stuart Cohen in Des Moines, Iowa.
President Bush delivers his State of the Union address tonight. The White House says Mr. Bush will propose steps to rein in rising health care costs and to establish health savings accounts for consumers. The Israeli military is admitting that an army bulldozer hit by a Hezbollah missile yesterday had crossed several yards into Lebanese territory. One soldier was killed in the attack. NPR's Peter Kenyon has more from Jerusalem.
Brigadier General Yair Golan said the Israeli bulldozer was clearing explosives planted by Hezbollah guerrillas. Yesterday, the army said the anti-tank missile hit the bulldozer inside Israeli territory. But today, Golan contradicted that, saying the army departed from standard procedure by going into Lebanon. Golan said the army still considers the attack an escalation by Hezbollah, and retaliation is still an option. In Beirut, a Hezbollah official said the group was ready to respond to an Israeli attack, but did not expect a major escalation. Separately, Israeli bulldozers demolished dozens of homes in the Rafah refugee camp in the southern Gaza Strip. Witnesses said family members desperately hurled belongings from windows and fled. The army said it targeted homes from which shots had been fired at soldiers. Peter Kenyon, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Wall Street, the Dow is down 66 points in heavy trading. This is NPR News from Washington. In NPR's business update, stocks have been retreating somewhat today despite strong profit reports from Citigroup, Johnson & Johnson, and 3M Company. Technology stocks have been unchanged, though. Analysts say a pullback is to be expected after the recent rise in stock prices. Martha Stewart today repeated her not guilty plea in a federal courtroom in New York City. Stewart is facing a 5-count indictment in her stock fraud trial, and lawyers are now in the process of narrowing the list of prospective jurors. Carrie Nolan of member station WNYC has more.
Federal Judge Miriam Goldman Cederbaum has barred the press from the interview process, claiming potential jury members might be intimidated by reporters. This is Stewart's first appearance since being charged with securities fraud, obstruction of justice, and making false statements. Prosecutors say she sold shares in biotech firm ImClone based on a tip from her former stockbroker, Peter Bukanovic. Bukanovic is also on trial and faces charges including perjury and obstruction of justice. Stewart claims she had a pre-existing arrangement with Bakanovic to sell ImClone shares if they dipped below $60 a share. If convicted, Stewart could face up to 30 years in prison and more than $1 million in fines. For NPR News, I'm Carrie Nolan.
Singular Wireless has made a formal offer to buy AT&T Wireless, according to sources close to the deal. That would create the nation's largest cellular phone carrier. USA Today reports Singular made an all-cash offer, but the price was not disclosed. The Salvation Army says it's getting one of the biggest charitable donations ever, likely to exceed $1.5 billion. It will come from the estate of Joan Kroc, the late widow of the founder of the McDonald's chain. I'm Craig Windham, NPR News in Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces The Puzzle Master Presents Volume 2 by Will Shortz, a new book of word puzzles and games heard on NPR's Weekend Edition Sunday at npr.org.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Before the sun could even rise on New Hampshire this morning, every major Democratic candidate running in next Tuesday's primary had arrived, including those who'd winged their way in from Iowa, some with a stiff political wind now at their backs. Iowa's winner was Massachusetts Senator John Kerry with 37% of the vote. Here he is early this morning in New Hampshire.
Thank you for a wonderful warm welcome on a cold morning in New Hampshire. And thank you. Thank you for welcoming back to New Hampshire. Come back, Kerry.
Also sailing into New Hampshire, North Carolina Senator John Edwards, a close second to Kerry in Iowa.
I can work 24 hours a day if that's what it takes. I'm so excited about being here in New Hampshire and bringing this message of positive hope. The politics of what's possible. That's what my whole campaign has been about. We're going to carry that campaign here to the state of New Hampshire.
Missouri Congressman Richard Gebhardt, fourth in his neighboring state of Iowa, was not in New Hampshire this morning. He's expected to drop out of the race later today.
My campaign to fight for working people may be ending tonight, but our fight will never end. We will reclaim the White House in 2004. Because we have to.
And here's former frontrunner Howard Dean attempting to drum up support.
We're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. We're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House. Yeah!
Some sounds from the Democratic presidential candidates on the campaign trail. And some sounds also on the campaign trail in New Hampshire are WBUR reporters Audie Cornish, Fred Tice, and Monica Brady. We turn first to Audie, covering surprise Iowa winner John Kerry. Audie, what's the mood at headquarters?
Well, right now I'm at Senator John Kerry's Manchester headquarters, where the phones are steadily ringing, and a lot of those calls are coming from people who want to attend his events this week. Now, in the past few months, the senator's campaign has been burdened with poll numbers that showed him losing ground to General Wesley Clark. This win in Iowa pretty much boosts him back onto the front pages and, more importantly, you know, back to the front of a pack that is fairly competitive. Now, at that rally that you played earlier at Manchester Airport, there are a few hundred people there, and Kerry actually called himself an underdog. He said that he'd only begun to fight. And it should be noted that he mostly reserved his criticism for President Bush, and he railed against the administration's economic and foreign policy. Kerry wasn't talking about Governor Dean. He wasn't talking about General Clark or even John Edwards. You know, he set his sights on November and a two-man race.
Audie Cornish with the Kerry campaign. Thanks, Audie.
Well, Fred Tice has been following second-place finisher John Edwards. Fred, up there in New Hampshire, what's your sense of Southerner Edwards' support up there in cold New Hampshire?
Well, I'm getting a snapshot of it now, Robin. I'm at the Manchester Public Library, where John Edwards is about to arrive. It's a room that fits normally about 150 people. There must be another 75 people packing the aisles. So the interest seems to be fairly high today in the wake of the Iowa caucuses last night. This morning, I talked to a couple of teachers who were in Hampton to hear John Kerry, and they said that the Iowa caucuses had, you know, had helped them make up their minds that they were going to support John Edwards.
Well, we're going to be speaking to Senator John Edwards in just a few minutes, but how big a campaign did he have there? I mean, there was a sense that he'd be focusing more on southern states.
The other campaigns have said that he definitely has had a small but very effective campaign here. He doesn't have the size of campaign, of course, that Howard Dean does or that John Kerry does. But he's getting good marks from some of the political professionals here.
Okay, Fred, thank you.
John Edwards.
Thank you. You're welcome.
Well, finally, Robin, we're joined by reporter Monica Brady, who's following Howard Dean. Monica, Dean was the front runner in Iowa. He finished with only 18%. How are people around Dean? Are they drooping or more determined than ever? What's the mood?
They're more determined than ever, that with the people I've spoken to. They say they're disappointed by his showing in Iowa. One woman said she's not thrilled, but she knows that he needs a strong showing in New Hampshire to keep his candidacy viable, and they believe he'll get it. So they feel, taken back resolve here to get him the votes he needs in New Hampshire to keep viable in this presidential race.
Monica, that fiery speech last night in Iowa with that sort of howl at the end of it, how is that going down with Dean's supporters?
Well, one woman told me that a tone of anger that's directed at Republicans is a good thing because she said the Democrats need to get angry. Another person said the jury's still out for them how they take that remark last night.
Could there be any transfer to a John Kerry on this electability issue, Monica, from the Dean camp?
Well, the supporters I spoke to still say they believe he is the most electable of all the candidates, and that they cited as one of the reasons they support him. So they think there needs to be a fresh face in Washington, not a Senator Kerry or a Senator Edwards, and that's why they're going for the outsider from Washington, Howard Dean.
He does still lead in the polls, doesn't he? Is there any sense of the strategy now against Kerry?
No sense yet. You know, he just took the stage, and he came on in a pretty subdued manner speaking to supporters. You know, he didn't jump on with any rousing, "We're taking New Hampshire by storm." He started by just thanking a list of people in New Hampshire in his campaign. So far, he's pretty subdued. He hasn't laid out any agenda yet, but he's still talking.
Monica, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
WBUR reporters Audie Cornish, Fred Tice, and Monica Brady on the campaign trails in New Hampshire.
Well, we turn now to two pundits following the nomination process. John Greenberg is executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio. Hi, John.
Hi, Robin.
And Stephen Schmidt is known as Dr. Politics on Iowa Public Radio. He's also a political science professor at Iowa State University. Welcome back, Stephen.
Hello.
And, Stephen, you were not alone in thinking that Howard Dean would perhaps squeak by with a win in Iowa. In your mind, what happened?
In the end, Dean's overly energetic outside army annoyed a lot of people. His team made people sort of feel as though they were a bunch of farmers falling off a turnip wagon. And his negativeness and his what some people called almost bitter or sour kind of campaign style at the end turned people off and made them think he's not going to be able to survive as he goes on. And so it was largely organization and personality and not so much issues, really, that destroyed him.
Well, John, is this possibly where experience pays off? Because we read in the Boston Globe today that Massachusetts campaign workers, known as some of the best in the country, stormed Iowa when there was a whiff of new life in Kerry's campaign last week. And so he had some stormtroops in there as well. But these are guys who have been around the block.
You know, I think that the basic problem that Dean had may have come down more to personality than to anything else. I do also see signs here in New Hampshire of Dean supporters who are becoming irritated by the Dean campaign and their over-solicitous attentions. But one of the things that I noticed about Dean is that as long as Dean early on was talking for other voters, for other people, he seemed fine. The other candidates got him to talk about himself. Mm. And it was at that point that he really didn't have a coherent message any longer. And that, all put together, makes it extremely challenging for any candidate to hold on to his base.
Well, Stefan, do you think that Dean is just wounded or mortally wounded? I mean, might New Hampshire be a better demographic fit for him in that, you know, there might be a lot of young, feisty people there?
I don't think so. There may be a lot of young, feisty people in New Hampshire, but, you know, the problem is really in many ways his personality. And when he came in third in Iowa, which was a shock and a huge surprise, and where he should have been humble and should have said, I'm going to look at where we failed, I'm going to study this. Instead, he came out with what many people thought was maybe a drug-induced or medication-induced sort of rally at the end, where he was tearing off his jacket and rolling up his sleeves and yelling and screaming into the microphone. Even people who supported him said, what happened to Dean at the end of this process? It was a bizarre performance, and it capped a personality quirkiness that I think in the end didn't wear very well.
But John, your thoughts?
Well, I would agree completely. I mean, I think that that speech did a lot of damage to Howard Dean. Now, that said, the one bright spot in all of those exit polls for Howard Dean is that the only group among whom he did very well were people who made up their minds more than a month ago. In New Hampshire, he's enjoyed a very powerful lead at one point. So there is at least the possibility that Howard Dean will still retain enough support and have a slightly different campaign approach here in New Hampshire. The other thing that you got to look at is that it's a very different complexioned race coming in here. And if Kerry and Clark and Edwards and Lieberman divide up the conservative moderates, then possibly Dean squeaks through.
John, a real quick question to you as well. You were talking about how the complexity had changed. Can you just shape it for us as you see it? What is the race now?
Right now, Dean is doing everything he can to hold on to the original message that originally brought people to him, and I'm not sure that it's going to work. I mean, it's very interesting to me that Howard Dean did what insurgent candidates very often do. They shape the agenda. Howard Dean came out and he was against the war, and he said all these other people were not against the war when you needed them to be against the war, and I'm the guy that was. But he made that point so early on that what happened is all the other candidates began saying, I'm against the war, I'm against the war, I'm against the war. And you know what happened? People really began to forget that they hadn't been against the war vociferously at the time when it counted.
Real quick, Stefan, how much did that visit that John Kerry had with the veteran that he'd saved in Vietnam, how much do you think that impacted Iowa voters? That was incredibly powerful.
It was huge, and this morning on my show, we did a one-hour show just on the caucuses, there was a flurry of calls of people who said that that made them switch to Kerry because it was so moving. I mean, a veteran that he hadn't seen, whose life he saved, comes up to him and then campaigns with him in the last few days. Tremendous.
Real quick, I hate to do this, but I'm going to. Predictions for New Hampshire, John.
It is impossible to predict New Hampshire right now. You can imagine any combination of scenarios that allows somebody to squeak by. I think you're going to see one of the most divided outcomes in this race that you've seen in a long, long time.
Well, we're not going to take your money, but I can't wait to talk to you again. Thank you both so much.
Bye, Robin.
Stefan Schmidt, political science professor at Iowa State University, speaking to us from Iowa, and John Greenberg, executive editor at New Hampshire Public Radio.
To hear your thoughts on campaign 2004, send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters@here-now.org.
Or you can call our listener line and leave a message at 617-358-0397. That's 617-358-0397. 1-800-387-0397.
You can send us mail the old-fashioned way. Mail your letters to Here and Now, 890 Commonwealth Avenue, Boston, Massachusetts, 02215.
Just ahead, fresh off a second-place win in Iowa, we speak to North Carolina Senator John Edwards.
There's more coming up Here and Now. I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
North Carolina Senator John Edwards is in New Hampshire after his surprise second-place Iowa finish. We spoke to him an hour ago and started by asking how he was feeling today.
I feel very good today.
Yeah, you bet you do. Well, you were one of the Mo's, as they called him, the guy with the momentum. You had the endorsement of the top newspaper in Des Moines. You had the sunny disposition. But now, as you know, you're facing Wesley Clark, a former NATO commando who just stared down Milosevic at The Hague, Senator John Kerry, who has about 20 years of seniority on you and a seat on the esteemed Foreign Relations Committee. And as you know, the Republicans are expected to say that foreign leaders will eat a nice guy like you for breakfast. So how do you convince the American people that you can lead in foreign affairs?
Oh, very easily. I've been involved in all these issues for years now. I'm on the Senate Intelligence Committee, investigated September 11th, why it happened, wrote the laws to make sure the American people are safe without taking away their rights and liberties, which is what this administration is doing. I've been to these parts of the world, Afghanistan, Pakistan, the Middle East, Europe, met with the leaders in all these parts of the world, been to our own security operations in these parts of the world, but then have a clear vision about how America should lead. For example, I'm the only person that's talked about how we should set up a global nuclear compact to stop the spread of nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, the single most important characteristic, and this is what we saw with the vote in Iowa last night, is people are looking for somebody who's strong, who has character, integrity, and good judgment. And I think those are all tests that I've met my entire life.
How will you signal to, let's say, Osama bin Laden that the war on terror is still on?
Well, there are a lot of things we need to be doing. Number one, overseas, one of the problems associated with the Bush administration's unilateral foreign policy is we don't have the relations we need with other countries. And if you're me and you've been watching these intelligence reports for years, you see where these terrorist organizations are, where their cells are. We can't get to them without the cooperation of these other countries. And there's also a great deal left to be done here at home. We should be doing a much more effective job of protecting our ports, our nuclear plants, chemical plants, making sure the communities are coordinated. We have a way to get a warning to them and they have a response in place.
Hmm. In a couple lines, sir, what is the first thing a President Edwards would say to Israeli President Ariel Sharon?
That I understand he feels like the Israeli people are under the threat of terrorism every day, but we have to take steps to move toward some level of belief by the Israelis and the Palestinians that peace can be obtained. And that means, for example, I'd say to him, we'll go to the Palestinians, ask them to arrest these two or three leaders of Hamas. If you agree in exchange to allow freer passage in the West Bank, we need to have either the Secretary of State or an envoy present and engaged over a long time. We need to find ways to create some level of trust between the parties. And then America needs to find ways to empower those within the PA, the Palestinian Authority, who actually want peace and want to reform.
Senator, you said you were against the President Bush's unilateralism, and yet you endorsed his decision to go to war in Iraq. What do you say to the majority of Democrats who were against that decision without insulting your constituents in, say, Camp Lejeune in your home state, many of whom not only supported the war but sacrificed sons and daughters to it?
I say to them the truth, that I did what I thought was best after examining the question very carefully and struggling with it. I did what I believed was right.
But in other words, that's what a lot of people in your home state want to hear. But what about...
Excuse me for interrupting. Mm-hmm. I don't say what anybody wants to hear. I say what I believe is true. I mean, I took this issue very seriously. And it, whatever the politics of it are, it was a decision that I knew would affect a lot of lives. And I exercised my best judgment, and it was based on a lot of things. It was based on nothing that President Bush was saying. It was based on my own examination of the information we had. The bottom line is, I did what I believed was right, and I would say that to anybody. And I also said that it was that in order for this thing to be successful, we couldn't do what the president is doing now, which is engaging in a unilateral American operation.
Senator Edwards, you're a millionaire trial lawyer who's opposed any cap on malpractice awards in a couple of cases. You represented a Raleigh lawyer who won $4.5 million against a management firm. You represented a family that won $23 million when their baby was born brain damaged. As you know, the Republicans are going to paint you as someone who profits from costly court settlements, and you have been against capping malpractice awards. So how do you explain any of that?
I say to them that I spent 20 years of my life fighting for kids, mostly, against big insurance companies and big corporations. The very corporations like Enron that have been abusing and committing fraud against the American people. These families needed somebody to stand up for them, and I stood up for them against these armies of lawyers for these big corporations, and I was proud of it. I don't say that we have the best legal system in the world, but it's not perfect. And you just raised the issue of medical malpractice premiums. See, I believe we need some changes. I think that we should have a process in place that puts more responsibility on the lawyers. I mean, I think these lawyers need to have more responsibility, take more responsibility than they're taking sometimes.
And finally, just quick, have you spoken to your folks back at home yet?
I have.
And we hear that your mom baked a pecan?
Because she usually makes pecan pies for me. She makes everything. My mother's the best cook on the planet.
Well, as I read in your hometown papers, even your mom seemed a little surprised that you did so well last night. What's that like for you to hear?
I talked to my parents last night. They were so exuberant and so excited. They completely believe in me, and they believe that I should be president. But it's hard not to be a little surprised by somebody who, in 3 weeks, went from 5% in the polls to 32% in a very strong second place finish. I mean, there was clearly a lot of momentum and movement there, and we're going to keep working our heart out here in New Hampshire too. Hmm.
Apparently, it was an apple and a chocolate chip pecan pie.
there's nothing my mother can't cook.
Well, Senator Edwards, thank you very much.
It's my honor to be with you.
Mm-hmm. Take care.
Bye.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, dedicated to accelerating the pace of discovery in engineering and science worldwide, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Coming up, President Bush gives his State of the Union address tonight. We'll have a preview and a look back at some of last year's initiatives. Where do they stand now?
Also, small-town Vermont life is captured by the lens of filmmaker John O'Brien in the Tunbridge trilogy.
These stories coming up here and now.
I'm Dolores Handy. It's a whole new ball game in the Democratic presidential race. Massachusetts Senator John Kerry, on the heels of last night's decisive win, 38% in the Iowa caucuses, wasted no time getting back on the campaign trail in New Hampshire today.
While I may be the underdog in this state, I have yet begun to fight and show the full measure of what we will do in this state.
Just as surprising as Kerry's win was the strong second-place finish by North Carolina Senator John Edwards. He garnered support of 32% at the Iowa caucuses. Edwards attributes that showing to the nature of his campaign, which he says is positive about lifting up the American people and making them believe again. Howard Dean is blaming his third-place showing in Iowa on negative attacks he suffered as a one-time frontrunner. Dean, who, like the other top finishers, touched down in New Hampshire early this morning to begin campaigning for next week's primary, says he's ready to fight like crazy until the New Hampshire primary. Dean says he's now an underdog and that he's banking on New Hampshire's tradition of supporting underdogs. For Missouri Congressman Richard Gebhardt, the Iowa caucuses proved costly. Finishing a disappointing fourth in a race he needed to win, Gebhardt conceded last night that his campaign may be ending. Instead of flying to New Hampshire, he flew to his home state and is expected to make an announcement about the future of his candidacy this afternoon at 2 o'clock Eastern Time. With campaign 2004 officially underway, President Bush will use tonight's high-visibility State of the Union address to highlight his election year agenda. The president's nationally televised speech will open with remarks on national security. He'll be urging Americans to support him in fighting terrorism and then move on to domestic priorities. He's expected to propose measures on health care, including offering tax incentives to bring more people into the health insurance system. The Israeli military is confirming an airstrike in southern Lebanon. Israeli planes attacked suspected Hezbollah guerrilla targets in the region today after an Israeli soldier was killed on a border a day earlier. Martha Stewart again affirms her innocence in the stock trading scandal. In federal court in New York today, Stewart repeated her not guilty plea to all five counts against her before final jury selection started. On Wall Street at midday, stocks are lower. The Dow is down 67 points. The NASDAQ down 5 points. The S&P 500 off 2.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
Tonight, President Bush delivers his State of the Union address at a political moment when the president continues to enjoy high support for his handling of national security issues, but lower numbers for his handling of domestic issues. How will that affect what he says before Congress? And do warnings in last year's State of the Union speech about the threat from Iraq, a threat some now consider overblown, shadow somehow the credibility of what's said tonight. We're joined now by Don Lambrow. He's chief political correspondent for The Washington Times. Don, welcome.
Thank you.
Don joins us from Fairfax Station, Virginia, and George Edwards III, a political scientist at Texas A&M University, no relation to Senator John Edwards of North Carolina. Welcome, George, from College Station, Texas.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
And nice to have both of you. George Edwards, this is an election year State of the Union address. How does that skew things, if at all?
Well, frankly, I don't think it makes too much difference, but it does provide a particular challenge because, on the one hand, he doesn't want to be polarizing because elections in the United States are won in the center. And so he doesn't want to be associated with what would be very controversial primary proposals. On the other hand, he has to have some meat in there. He has to project some kind of vision, and usually that means that not everyone's going to like that vision if it's a real vision. So that's the particular challenge you have in the election year.
Don, your thoughts on that? It's an election year State of the Union.
Oh, absolutely. And every proposal you'll have in there can be connected to some constituency, either a constituency that's in the Republican Party in a strong one form, but also those that he wants to reach out in the center and beyond. Certainly his proposal on immigration reform is going to be dealt with, and that goes to a huge base, the Democratic Party. He gets about 34% of Hispanics. I think he wants to push that to 40%, so he's going to deal with that and defend it. And then there's the space proposal, I think, for a lot of Americans. This is looked at as a visionary proposal. It'll be very good for the economy. It's very long-term. He's got his unfinished agenda. He wants action on energy, on tort reform, on pension reform. I think he'll mention Social Security. That is an issue that Democrats thought they could win a lot of seats on. It hasn't played to them. It is not the third rail. The younger people want to be able to invest some of that money. And I think he'll bring that up and try to get that, at least a dialogue going in this coming election. So if he wins a mandate, he can move on that in the next Congress.
Don, on Iraq, what will he highlight? I ask that in the context of 500 post-war deaths now, no weapons of mass destruction found. How does he work that?
Well, I think he's going to talk about the gains the colleges in Iraq are packed, the schools are packed, much more oil is flowing. It is a tough long haul, but they're both ready to put together a government in June or July, or if not earlier. They will pass authority from the United States, the coalition forces, to the Iraqi government. So he's going to emphasize the good, the advances being made there, and that America has to stick to this because this is all a part of the war on terrorism. And that he'll talk a lot about because that is going to be a major, I think, an issue that will override all of the elections with, of course, the economy.
George Edwards, is there a shadow on this State of the Union address at all because of what was warned about in last year's, that, for example, Saddam Hussein had enough anthrax to, quote, kill several million people, enough botulinum to subject millions to respiratory failure? We heard about buying uranium from Niger and aluminum tubes to make nuclear weapons. Does that shadow this speech, or is that the past?
Well, I think to some degree. I think I don't know if it shadows it, but it certainly provides an element of skepticism about claims. It's interesting. I just read last year's State of the Union message, and about a third of the message is about war with Iraq. And almost that entire portion of the State of the Union message is focused on weapons of mass destruction. There's almost no other argument for going to war with Iraq than that. So it's not that he's lost all the goodwill of the American people, not by any means. But I think there is a skepticism there, and people are going to listen a little more attentively.
I bet Libya comes up tonight, Don Lambrow.
It may. I think a lot of good things on the foreign policy front have flowed from Iraq, and I think he's going to mention that as another element here.
Mention that Libya has opened itself to foreign nuclear inspectors and clearly wants to get back in the family of nations, as we say, which the Bush administration says is a result of its policy in Iraq.
That's right. And it's no coincidence that Gaddafi sought out negotiations from the British and from the United States the week that we were invading Iraq. So the president can say a lot of good things have flowed from that. We see the reform element making some progress and headway in Iran and Syria trying to be a little bit nicer. he's going to try to, as he has in the past, join together in the American people's minds that fighting terrorism, the war in Iraq, getting Iraq to become a major new democracy in the middle of the Middle East, is going to make America safer and is going to be a defeat for terrorism. And that's a strong argument, and I think that's going to be a major element in his speech.
George Edwards, he's a Republican president in an election year running historically high deficits, approaching $500 billion. Does that matter to people? How does he work that in this speech?
Well, people certainly don't like the deficits because, in principle, people are fiscally conservative. But the people who have traditionally been most concerned about this are Republicans, and he has phenomenally high levels of support among Republicans. So while some may grumble about it, they're going to vote for him.
Don Lambro, we hear about this 7 to 10% slice of the American public who may make the winner next November. They're those who haven't already made up their mind that they're going to vote either Democratic or Republican. How does President Bush try to win over those critical voters?
Well, I think there probably will be proposals that will be aimed at single women. I think maybe on the economic side of things, in terms of their incomes, in terms of pension reform. So I think he'll probably be having some proposals there. I think he certainly will be reaching out to the black community. He did that in, his last State of the Union address with his big initiative on fighting AIDS in Africa and giving increased funding to historically black colleges. He's certainly going to be reaching out to those constituencies in that 7 or 8, 10% or more that are formerly the base of the Democratic Party. And I mentioned immigrants earlier. That's another huge, it's the largest, of course, minority group and the biggest part of the Democratic base. Now Democrats are saying it can no longer be counted as part of our base, and it's up for grabs.
George Edwards, your thoughts on any political heat, any surprises the president may try to generate tonight to win over these swing voters we hear so much about?
I frankly don't think you're going to see any substantial domestic policy proposals that cost a lot of money. Because of the budget constraints. But I think you're going to see a lot of overtures towards various segments of the population, often in largely symbolic ways, I think.
George Edwards III is a political scientist at Texas A&M. George, thanks very much.
My pleasure.
And Don Lambro is chief political correspondent for The Washington Times. Thanks to you, Don.
Thank you.
And thank you both.
Still to come, the filmmaker who made Farmer Fred Tuttle a household name in Vermont has a new movie out, this one pitting Vermonters against the dreaded out-of-staters known as Flatlanders.
You're listening to Here and Now. $50 million for an indoor rainforest, $2 million for a golf awareness program, and money to keep the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, well, rockin'. All portions of what some would consider pork in the omnibus federal spending bill. It's scheduled for a vote in the Senate this afternoon on this first day Congress is back in session. Will the bill pass? Should it? Alexander Bolton is following the story for the congressional newspaper The Hill. He joins me on the line from Washington. Hi, Alexander.
Hi.
Alexander, is it going to pass this afternoon, this $820 billion bill that's been out there since October?
The thinking right now is that it won't pass, and the Republicans have been whipping the bill feverishly last week and this morning, trying to round up the 60 votes they need to defeat a Democratic filibuster. And but yesterday, Harry Reid, the assistant Democratic leader, basically said that he would not defect from his party and vote with the leaders to delay the bill, not allow a vote on the bill, and that means that Republicans likely won't prevail, at least not today. Of course, anything can happen.
How much concern is there in Congress about what we referred to in our opening, pork in the bill? There's always pork in the bill, right?
Well, there's not much concern in Congress about pork in the bill. Members of Congress like pork,
yeah,
with few exceptions. I mean, there are some conservatives on the Hill and fiscal conservatives who kind of wage crusades against pork.
Yeah, there's some dissent out there. Yeah.
People like Senator John McCain in the Senate and Representative Jeff Flake in the House, people like that, they'll wage the battle against pork. But by and large, members of Congress like it because it means it means money for their constituents. And when you come right down to it, what constituents pay most attention to is what what concrete benefits you're bringing back to them in the form of bridges or roads or even golf courses and Rock and Roll Hall of Fame.
What do I get? And the Democrats are upset about a sense, they say, that the White House is not allowing more compromise on all sorts of things.
Yes.
Now, just to finish up, how does this affect average people when a massive spending bill like this, hundreds of billions of dollars, just doesn't get passed?
If Congress cannot come to some sort of deal or cannot pass this omnibus bill this week, what's likely to happen is, or at least what Republican leaders have threatened to do, is pass a year-long continuing resolution which would fund government at last year's levels. And what that means is that all the funding increases and inflation adjustments that are part of this large omnibus package, they won't get passed, and everything, funding will basically be frozen. So we're talking about $6 billion for various federal programs that won't be added to government agencies, added to government budgets. So that just means less money for programs like veterans health care or Head Start or the fight against the global spread of AIDS. So you know, how does that affect the common citizen? It just depends, you know, what sort of services they're getting from the government.
Alexander Bolton is staff writer for the congressional newspaper The Hill. Alexander, thanks so much.
Thank you.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
Filmmaker John O'Brien has finished the third movie in his Tunbridge trilogy, an homage to his hometown of Tunbridge, Vermont. The second film, A Man with a Plan, featured local farmer Fred Tuttle as a fictional political candidate, but it catapulted Fred to fame and into a real-life race for the Senate. John's latest release is called Nosy Parker. It won a special jury prize for outstanding direction at last year's Nantucket Film Festival. In the film, John explores the age-old theme of outsider versus native, tourist versus townie, or as they say in Vermont, the plain-spoken sons of Ethan Allen and the Green Mountain Boys versus those puzzling New Yorkers known as Flatlanders. 30-something Natalie and her much older psychiatrist husband have moved to Vermont to rejuvenate their marriage and build their dream house, which in this scene is being inspected by the town's property tax assessors, or as they're called in Vermont, listers.
So they have a dishwasher, too? Oh,
there must be a dishwasher right here.
Stands to reason. Well, now, this must be the refrigerator.
Yeah, that's the refrigerator.
And that's butternut, too?
Yeah.
Must be.
It's the same as everything else.
Here, more cupboards.
Yeah.
Both sides.
Uh-huh. Does that
mean
something?
So the kitchen sort of extends around the corner, doesn't it?
Well, this is it. What you see is what you get.
A scene from Nosy Parker, the new film from John O'Brien, and he joins us in the studio. Welcome.
Thank you, Robin.
Well, my cousins from Vermont are going to love this.
They may have seen it already.
Oh, well, you know, you are not overplaying the way the two camps, you know, warily eye each other, or if not warily, maybe with bemusement, eye each other, right?
A lot of Vermont towns have, there's quite a bit of tension, actually, between the sons of Ethan Allen and the Flatlanders. Mm-hmm. And so I was coming at this being somewhere in the middle, not being really an old Vermonter, given that my parents moved there in the 50s.
You don't even count.
Close. Right, but I'm not a new Vermonter in that I've been there 40 years on the same sheep farm. So I wanted to just get at the complexities of this moment in Vermont.
One of my cousins at one point, Vermont got so crowded that he moved to the outback of Australia. But let's get back to the plot of your film. Instead of rejuvenating the marriage that we spoke of, Natalie becomes very lonely. She wants children. And she begins to spend a lot of innocent time with George. George is hired on as a handyman. He's a 70-something fellow from the town. He's played by George Lyford. Tell us about George. Is he really from Tunbridge?
He was from Chelsea, the next town north. Mm-hmm. And we had been friends for about 20 years. I got to know him in high school. And he was a real Vermont dairy farmer. And whereas the couple that moves up to Vermont is played by, they're both played by professional actors. Mm-hmm. So there's a really interesting mix going on between professional and non-professional actors.
Let's listen to a scene where Natalie, the young woman, hires on George as her handyman.
Do you know some kid who could we could hire to do chores?
Gosh, I don't know. No,
really?
No. What do you want him to do?
Well, you know, like pick apples and, you know, mow the lawn, split wood, and do all the, you know, change, you know, storm windows, stuff like that. All the stuff that
I don't have much to do. Maybe I could do that.
How much, John O'Brien, was your film improv?
The whole thing. I write a story, and then I think people are great characters to begin with. I mean, certainly in documentaries you get that. And so I just cast the very funny and charismatic people I know who are my neighbors. And in this case, I found these two professional actors who are also great at improv.
Then you also have a Greek chorus of people from the town. Are these real people from the town?
Real people and the real neighbors of the real couple that lived in this big house.
Well, that's what I wanted to ask you, because this house really is, it's one of those that would make my cousins in Vermont just roll their eyes. What do they need those things for? It's huge. I mean, it's house beautiful, plopped down in the middle of this dairy land. And well, let's listen to, as some of the people around town, they're like chickens in the chicken coop. They're just on the phone all the time talking about these outsiders who've moved in.
It's destroyed our view, and my husband is livid about it.
And I had no idea when we came here that this would be a possibility.
Well, I still don't understand how it's happened.
It's not the view that I came to Vermont for. We had hoped to look down and see treetops, and instead we look down and see Malibu.
So now, John, you tell us that these are real people from the town who are talking about the real house that's been built in their midst. This is in your fictional film, but what does that do about the? Doesn't that rub raw some of the feelings in town? That really do exist.
The real couple that built this big house actually got divorced.
Was no one in town surprised that they'd gotten divorced? Since there seems to be suspicion about what keeps these couples who don't seem to do anything. They're not farming. They're not, like, what are they doing up there? You know, there seems to be suspicion about what do you do if you're not working hard on a farm?
No, I don't think anybody was surprised. And I think the day after the divorce went through, the husband married for the fourth time.
There's also a scene where George admires an old horse fork that's hanging on Natalie's wall as sort of, you know, a lovely, like a museum piece. It illustrates further the divide between the people who work the land and the people who buy the land. Let's listen.
What do you do with that horse fork up there?
Horse fork?
Yeah, that's a horse hay fork. They use horses to pull it up with.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh, I didn't know that.
We call them a horse fork.
You ever use one?
Oh, sure.
Really?
You put a horse on the rope outdoors.
Yeah?
Put it through the pulleys and it went up. When it hit that little trolley, it would go where you want it. And then there's a thing on the side with a trip rope on it. You pull that and that dumped the hay right where you wanted it.
I don't understand. But anyway, I like the way it looks. Yeah. I love farm antiques.
Yeah. Well, I'm an antique farmer.
Yeah, huh?
I'm thinking, John O'Brien, that your Vermont film is very timely right now with one of the most famous flatlanders from Vermont gallivanting across the country. I'm thinking of Howard Dean.
Right. Well, the funniest story I have about Howard Dean is Fred Tuttle, who was the star of my previous movie. When Howard was in his last gubernatorial election, it was very close, and he came to Fred and begged him to do a commercial for him. And Fred said, oh, let me think about it. They went up on this, the highest point in Tunbridge, and there was a state trooper who was with the governor guarding him. And Howard Dean and Fred wandered away. This beautiful sunset was happening. And Fred said all he could think about when they were about 200 yards away from the state police car was how easy it would have been to strangle Howard Dean.
Well,
so he did the ad, and Howard won his re-election.
Well, we should let people hear a little bit of Fred after that comment in case they haven't seen him in his movie. He was an irascible fellow, and he makes an appearance in your movie. You didn't have to beg. There's a scene where, as a neighboring farmer, he meets up with young Natalie jogging by.
Nice to meet you, Fred. I'm Natalie Newman.
Is that who you are?
That's
yes,
who I am.
Know. I've seen you jogging by several times.
You have, yeah.
You live up here in the new house?
That's right.
That big house up
there? That's
by?
Where I live, yeah.
Oh, it's a big house to heat in the winter, isn't it?
Oh, yeah.
You live
well,
there
we don't know yet. I mean, we just
Oh, you
moved
just
in.
Bought it. You just come, yeah?
Yeah.
You like Tunbridge?
I love it.
You like
yeah.
all the people here?
Well, the ones I've met so far, they seem
Yeah, you
just...
like me, then.
You're great.
Yeah, good.
Another scene from John O'Brien's trilogy of Vermont movies. It's called Nosy Parker. Couple quick questions, John. Nosy Parker? Everybody around here knew that phrase. I didn't know it.
It's an old English term meaning a nosy person or a busybody.
Yeah, your mom
so
says
So don't
to you,
be a nosy Parker.
Don't be a nosy Parker. Yeah. I did not know that. And I just, you know, as we heard from Fred Tuttle, George, who does star in this movie, both men have passed away. George in the middle of filming this movie.
Right, yeah.
And it strikes me that in addition to making movies, which is fun, I wonder how much of your work is about trying to preserve your town.
That's where the whole thing started off, was that I wanted to document all my old neighbors before they passed away. And so I came up with this idea of anthropological comedies where I was going to add the document part to something that was entertaining. And so it's this really interesting mix. It's quite experimental, but at the same way, it's very accessible. Mm-hmm. I mean, the nicest thing about this film is that I've had old and new Vermonters come up, and they both like it equally.
John, thanks very much.
Thank you, Robin.
John O'Brien's latest film is called Nosy Parker. For more information on screenings, go to our website at here-now.org.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
And join us again here and now.
For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now.
How will the Democratic presidential candidate spin the results in Iowa?
And promises kept and broken. As we ready for this year's State of the Union address, we look at last year's.
That's Public Radio's Midday News Magazine, Here and Now.